From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
I don't debate today with members of the Flat Earth Society. That issue is closed. You know, it's not one that anybody wants to debate. I don't debate about whether homosexuality is evil or good. It's morally neutral. Yeah. So is heterosexuality. Can you misuse it? Of course. Yeah. And I think part of what the Christian church has got to do is to help people accept what they are and then find a way to live it out with dignity and holiness and integrity, right, instead of saying, well, you can't be that, because that's unacceptable to us.
Despite his advanced age and serious health challenges, it was nonetheless a shock to hear of the passing last Sunday of the Right Reverend John Shelby Spong, retired Episcopal Bishop of Newark, New Jersey, and a towering figure in fearless, faithful, loving, progressive theology for many decades. While he had many detractors, as any prophet will, Spong is named again and again as the writer, the voice, and the conscience that helped lead countless despairing Christians back to their faith. Bishop Spong left behind his wife, Christine, five children, and their families. He also left us with dozens of powerful, disruptive, challenging, and inspiring books that will continue to help countless readers find new ways into sacred places they thought were closed to them. This is the legacy of John Shelby Spong. Over the years, we were so lucky to have him return often to State of Belief Radio. While we couldn't possibly share all of our favorite excerpts on today's tribute show, we'll highlight some and direct you to a full archive of our time together at stateofbelief.com. We'll also get the thoughts of the Right Reverend Gene Robinson, the retired Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire. An important note, we had promised to bring you part two of our wide-ranging conversation with dissenting Catholic theologian Charles Curran this week, with the full hour dedicated to remembering Bishop Spong. That powerful interview with Father Curran will be coming your way next weekend.
I'm Ray Kirstein at the intersection of religion, politics, and unintended consequences. As right-wing American Catholic bishops continue to prioritize culture war agendas over everything else, Pope Francis has again spoken out strongly on attempts to deny the sacrament of Holy Eucharist to political leaders who won't fall in line with anti-abortion demands from the Church, saying, quote, "If we look at the history of the Church, we can see that every time the bishops did not act like shepherds when dealing with a problem, they aligned themselves with political life on political problems." The pontiff added that he himself has never denied communion to anyone. Meanwhile, the inevitable next and very predictable slip down the ever-expanding, deeply held convictions slippery slope of demanded rights, a pastor in Oklahoma is trading religious exemptions from COVID vaccination mandates for donations to his church. I suppose an added benefit for Jackson Lehmeyer will also be an increase in funeral business down the road. And after prominent Christian nationalists failed in their collaboration with California's gubernatorial recall this week, all eyes are on this weekend's rally in Washington, D.C., celebrating the terrorists of January 6th as, quote-unquote, political prisoners, which has the predictable blessing of the theocratic religious right. Intent on undermining the Biden administration and the rule of law, Christianist conspiracy theorists continue to misuse religious language to push events like this. Authorities are seriously concerned about violence at the event, which also has the support of groups with names like White Lives Matter. Amazing how we're still getting so much winning.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you every week to subscribe to it if you haven't already done so. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, some of you have, I know. Thank you. Thank you so much. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now to our guest. Among his many contributions to civil rights and human dignity, Bishop John Shelby Spong ordained the first openly gay man, Robert Williams, into the Episcopal priesthood in 1989. Only 14 years later, the denomination elected its first openly gay bishop, the Right Reverend Gene Robinson. Unforgettably, Bishop Spong remarked on that occasion that Gene was not the first gay Episcopal bishop, only the first honest one. And so it only is fitting to have Bishop Gene Robinson join us as we struggle to come to terms with the loss of this great friend. Gene, thank you for doing this today.
I'm just delighted to be here, Wilton, as always.
I know this is a profoundly personal loss for you. What was your relationship with him like?
So my relationship with Jack Spong was multifaceted over a period of years. Like everyone else, I knew him by reputation first. He was a kind of firebrand and a pioneer and out there on the edge. He was always making people mad. And whether you agreed with him or disagreed with him, you wanted to go round and round with him, right? He had a way of pulling people in and saying things in a way that would get you to be very thoughtful about your faith and what you did believe and why. So first of all, it was by reputation. In 1998, was the first time I was actually nominated to be a bishop, and that was in Jack Spong's diocese, and it was to elect the successor to Jack Spong. And so I was one of those five or six people, and he did a wonderful thing, which I've actually never heard of any other sitting bishop do, which is he invited each of the nominees, myself included, to spend a day with him. And it was fascinating and so interesting. I think the thing in that part of my relationship with him that I learned, two things. One is what a great pastor he was. You almost never hear that said, but he was really, at least with the people that I talked with, he was really a good pastor to his clergy and people, but especially the clergy, who are the bishop's particular flock, if you will. And the other thing is, I wondered how, as a sitting bishop, he churned out all of these books. And I think his secret was he got up at some ungodly hour every morning, 4 o'clock, something like that, and he wrote every day. And that included Sundays when he had visitations to congregations and was preaching and so on. But he literally wrote every day and claimed that made him the writer that he was. And he was quite a brilliant writer. Yeah. And then lastly, currently I'm the vice president of religion and senior pastor at Chautauqua Institution in far western New York. And Jack came there many times to lecture. And my very first year there, the summer of 2018, he was scheduled to speak all week as part of the religion lecture program. And on his first lecture on Monday, he announced that this visit to Chautauqua would be his last public appearance. Yeah. And that he would not be speaking publicly any longer. He, of course, had suffered a stroke a couple of years before that and had been somewhat disabled. The lovely thing to see was he had his wife, Christine, with him. And in the middle of the lecture, if there was a word he couldn't quite fetch from his brain or a name that he wanted to cite, he would turn to Christine, and literally 99% of the time, she would know exactly the word of the person he was going for. So it gave us a chance to see that relationship in progress. And then at the end of that week, of course, we knew, and he knew, that it was the last public lecture that he would be giving. So it was a very emotional time. Oh. And lots of tears, because people at Chautauqua loved him. Whether they agreed with him or not, they loved him because he inspired them to do their own thinking. And then when he left, I found a note that he left for me, which I believe began something like, we'll probably not see each other again in this life, but I just want to thank you, and on and on. It was just a sweet and kind side of Jack that certainly his detractors and his enemies would never give him that. But indeed, he was a human being just like the rest of us, and he had a soft, wonderful, sweet side.
Yeah. Bishop Spong took delight not just in promoting inclusivity in the church, but actively making sure it happened. What were you witness to along those lines?
So let's start with that I loved this man and stood on his shoulders and the shoulders of the work that he did. There's no question in my mind that I would not have been elected a bishop in 2003 had it not been for the work and ministry of Jack Spong, both within the church and far beyond it. On the other hand, I think it's honest to say he was kind of reckless. He was sort of a take no prisoners kind of guy. And so, and he loved controversy. So he would often say things in a way that he just knew would spark some sort of a controversy, either local or international. And he pursued his commitment, his gospel commitment to inclusivity in a somewhat reckless way. He would just include someone, like ordaining Robert Williams to the priesthood, and then just let the chips fall where they may. And if it caused an uproar, well, that was fine with him. And so there were people who saw that as reckless in a really negative way, and that it hurt the church and so on. But most of the time, I think he was reckless in a provocative way, and usually around some issue that the church needed to be provoked. And so he played that very well. The one thing I will say is that he became quite unpopular in the Episcopal Church because of all this controversy and because of his style. Mm-hmm. And to some people's thinking, his recklessness. But I will tell you how he was unique. And that was, he was a bishop to all those people who had it up to here with the church and couldn't stomach institutional religion anymore, and yet still had a belief in God and still longed for making the scriptures relevant and possible for people. So he became a bishop to those who had, for the most part, left the institutional church, but would certainly have considered themselves spiritual, and I think even religious. They just couldn't abide organized religion so much. And he became their pastor and their advocate. They practically worshipped him in Australia. I was there for a couple of book tours, and you would just say his name, and people's eyes would just glaze over with with admiration and honor for him.
Yeah.
So he had this ministry beyond the church at a time when the Episcopal Church had grown weary of him. I will say this, you know, his early books, I think, are among the finest theological work anywhere. And his, I believe it was his first book, This Easter Moment, was brilliant and incredibly orthodox, and yet brought a freshness to the accounts of the resurrection in the scriptures. But as he grew and thought theologically, he became less and less orthodox and more kind of on the edge, or some would say had gone over the edge. And I disagreed with a lot of where he went in his later life. But I don't think that takes away from all that he did in his life and ministry, nor his earlier writings, which by anyone's account are orthodox.
Yeah. You know, I'm having a hard time with the posthumous condemnation Bishop Spong is predictably receiving from this right-wing Christian voices. But criticism was nothing new to him. Do you remember, how did he handle the criticism that came at him?
It's hard for me not to put my own life and faith in as a substitute, because I didn't know him deeply enough to know precisely how he dealt with that. But it was certainly true for me, and I believe it was true for Jack, that he was so convinced of God's love for him that he regarded all of this criticism as small potatoes. Like he heard it, but he kind of let it run off his back like water off a duck. I think because he was so steeped in God's love for all of God's children. I mean, let's remember that all of this work that he did around inclusivity related to his profound and deep belief that God loves all of us, and there are. There is no asterisk after all of us, indicating that there are some exceptions to all of us. When he said all, he meant all.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've already talked about 2018 and when he made that announcement about ending his public speaking. His last State of Belief appearance was in March of that same year, and he was as open about the medical challenges he had endured as he was about his faith journey and personal evolution. I just wonder how you kept your breath hearing him make that announcement.
I didn't. I was breathless, just like everyone else. He had not particularly warned us that he was going to make that announcement. And so it stunned those of us doing the program at Chautauqua, as well as those who were there to participate in it. The one thing that he did that very first day, the Monday of the week of lectures, that I don't think I've ever heard anyone do, he described what it was like having a stroke. Hmm. I mean, like in real detail. What it felt like as a human being having a stroke. And it was so especially poignant because here was a man who lived and breathed ideas. I mean, his thinking, both theological and otherwise, was his life. And so to experience something like a stroke and wondering if you're ever going to get to speak again, or think in the way that you've been thinking your whole life again. It was just very, very powerful and very personal and intimate. I've never known anyone to do that.
Hmm. I'm not sure that it's even possible to describe the impact Bishop John Shelby Spong has had on Christianity and on the world, but in a few moments, I want you to try that.
You're right. It's difficult. It's difficult to sum up anyone's life, but for someone like Jack, who had contributed so much, even more impossible. I would say that pioneers have a special mission. Maybe they have a special place in God's heart. I don't know. But Jack was one of the people who began a self-reflection in the church about how it had historically treated gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer people. Although in those days, we were mostly just talking about gay and lesbian people. Yeah. But he was central, not the only one, but he was central in introducing that struggle. And I think it's an especially lonely place to be. And it's certainly a scary place to be. I mean, we never talked about it, but I'm sure he had threats on his life. But he believed it so profoundly, and he so believed that the church was called to open itself to LGBTQ people, that he kept at it no matter how lonely it was or how scary it was. I think he certainly, in my estimation, qualifies as a modern day prophet. And not the way we use prophecy mostly today, which is sort of foreseeing the future, but in the way the Jews used it in the Hebrew scriptures, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos. These were the people who stood up and spoke to power and told them precisely what they didn't want to hear, mm-hmm. but precisely needed to hear, yeah. and then paid the price for it.
Yeah.
That's what prophets do,
yeah.
and that's what happens to them. That's who Jack Spong was, and that's what happened to him.
I want you to make a contribution to our listeners that could be very helpful. With so many groundbreaking books to his credit, Gene, I wonder if you could recommend one title for someone only now hearing of Bishop Spong and interested in getting a first taste of his brilliant writings. Where would you say start and then go from there?
I want to go back to that first book, This Easter Moment. Mm-hmm. I think in that book, he tackles one of the most basic questions in Christianity, which is, did Jesus rise from the dead?
Mm-hmm.
And was that the event that launched the church? And one of the great things about Jack is that he's quite open about his own skepticism, the kinds of questions that he had. And it's in a sense, his books are his own, the thinking that's going on in his mind. And then he lets us listen in. And I think that book is one of the best I've ever read for those trying to understand whether or not the resurrection was as central as Christianity claims it would be. The other book I would recommend is Saving the Bible from Fundamentalists.
Yes.
This was a big point that Jack would make in all of his books, really. That we have to talk about that book, right?
Yeah.
We can't, if you're talking with someone who believes that those were words dictated by God, and you're a person who believes that it was either the ancient Jewish community or ancient Christians who were trying to describe as best they could their relationship with a living God, if those are the two people who are trying to have a conversation, they are going to miss each other like ships in the night,
yeah.
if they don't talk about that question.
That's
like,
right.
How do we regard this book?
Yeah.
He talked about it in almost all of his books. He certainly demonstrated it in all of his books. And I think it was also one of the great contributions that he made to say out loud that this is a conversation we need to have and ought to have.
Gene, have we covered it well enough? Is there anything about Bishop John Shelby Spong that you need our listeners to hear that we haven't talked about?
We've talked about it, but I want to go back to it.
Okay.
That inside this firebrand, inside this provocateur, was the heart of a pastor. And I think it contains the key, or at least a key, to understanding his life in ministry. And I would say it probably prevented him from going even further afield from orthodoxy than he did. He was a complicated and wonderfully thoughtful human being, and the church and the world is better for having known him.
The Right Reverend Gene Robinson is the retired Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire and a great, great friend. As the first openly gay man elected as bishop by the denomination, he is uniquely qualified to weigh the incredible impact of life and ministry of Bishop John Shelby Spong had and continues to have on the religion and on the world. Gene, I can't tell you how thankful I am for you to be with us today and share all of these memories.
Well, it's always a great pleasure to be with you, Welton, and especially on this occasion when we remember this giant of the church.
On this week's show, we're remembering the late Bishop John Shelby Spong, who passed away on September 12th at the age of 90. I'll never forget driving to his home in Montclair, New Jersey, with my producer, Ray Kirstein. It was 2013, and Spong had just published his 25th book, The Fourth Gospel, Tales of a Fourth Century Mystic. But in the hour we spent together, we covered a lot more ground than that.
I'm absolutely convinced of the reality of God, the meaning of the holy, the transcendent. I'm not convinced of anybody's definition of that God. And so I see my life as a journey into the mystery of that God. The only path I know how to walk is the Christ path. If I were a Buddhist, I'd walk the Buddhist path, but I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not a Jew. I'm not a Muslim. I don't have any disrespect for these three, but the path I know, the path has been opened to me to walk is the Christ path into the mystery of God, so I walk it. I don't believe that God's a Christian. And I think if I walk my path, my Christ path, deeply enough, I'll transcend all the limits of my religion. My hope is that the Jew and the Muslim and the Buddhist and the Hindu will do the same thing as they walk their path into the mystery of God, and that once we transcend the limits of human religion, then maybe we'll be able to share in a way that we can't share now. We don't have to sacrifice anything. I can say to my friends in other faiths, from walking the Christ path, this is the gift that I have received, and I want to share it with you. And they can say, well, this is a gift I've received from walking the Jewish path, the Muslim path, etc. And I want to share it with you. And so we can take on the treasures of the other without anybody having to sacrifice their principles. I describe myself as having an overdeveloped left brain and an underdeveloped right brain. But once you get through my brain and convert my mind, there's no way I can't act on that new conviction. And so when I became aware, after a lot of study with some doctor friends of mine, that homosexuality is simply one aspect on the spectrum of human sexuality, and that it's neither good nor bad, and it's not chosen, it's simply you awaken to it. I didn't choose to be heterosexual. I just woke up when girls didn't seem obnoxious to me any longer. I didn't make a decision about it. I just sort of followed my glands, I guess.
Yes.
And so you realize that others don't do that either. And so it makes no sense to discriminate against people because their skin is different from yours, or their gender is different from yours, or their sexual orientation, or their left-handed is different from mine. Lots of things in the human family that set us apart from one another. And we fear anything that's different. That's one of the basis of our biology. I think we've been taught to fear anything that's different because it's a threat to survival, and survival drives every living thing, from a plant to a human being. So the process of seeing humanity as human and to see God in the midst of humanity, which is the center of the Jesus story, just drives you to a set of different conclusions. And I've walked through these revolutions, and I think history will record that I've been on the right side of all of them. And the church, by and large, as an institution, has been on the wrong side of every one of them and has had to be dragged screaming and kicking past that boundary. But we do make it. You know, as I look at my church today, North Carolina, where I grew up, has one Episcopal bishop, and he's an African-American elected by the people. That's a long road from arresting people who come to worship in a white church to electing an African-American to be the top of your church's structure. My church has a woman as the presiding bishop. If we had the comparable office to the Archbishop of Canterbury in America, she is a female, and she is a very competent female. My church now has two openly gay bishops, and we've got a number of gay clergy. I had 35 when I retired, perfectly open and male and female, and living with their partners. In most cases, some were single, but most of them were living with their partners. And there was never any conflict about this. I've watched these revolutions, and I'm really grateful to have had a chance to share in them.
You know, Bishop Spong, you are making a point that is so resonant with me, because I grew up in the South as well, and what you described was my background. You encountered biblical fundamentalism, and you encountered what you called ecclesiastical fundamentalism. How did you do that and realize that fundamentalism was wrong, but retain a respect for the Bible and a respect for the church?
That's an interesting trick. I guess there's a part of me that still respects the fundamentalism, not the hardcore misunderstanding. But I was a child in a fairly dysfunctional home. My father was an alcoholic, and he died when I was 12. And fundamentalism gave me a sense of security that I didn't have in my family. And so I don't want to disrespect it at this stage in my life. My mother died a fundamentalist. And so I began to see fundamentalism more as a personality style and a cover for insecurity than I do anything else. And so the last thing I want to do is to hate the fundamentalist or even to judge the fundamentalist. But I'm not going to be one. I believe that every time a human being tries to define God, that they commit idolatry, because they act as if God can fit into the categories of the human mind. And yet, I'm not going to be godless. That is, I don't know how to be godless. I call myself a God-intoxicated human being. But the form of God is very non-defined. I loved a statement that a retired bishop made to me on one occasion, and I find myself repeating it. He said, "The older I get, the more deeply I believe, but the less beliefs I have." And I think that's sort of where I am today. Yeah. I love going to church. I say the creeds every Sunday. I have no trouble with the creeds. I regard them as a fourth century love song that our ancestors sang to God. It doesn't bother me that they reflect a three-tiered universe that no longer exists in anybody's mind except the most illiterate. But the creeds, to me, are the way we framed our worship song in the 4th century. So I can sing the 4th century song. I don't literalize it. I don't think it's a straitjacket or girdle into which I've got to force my flabby faith. But I think it's a guide along the way. This is how we understood reality. Now, I live in the 21st century. I've got to understand reality in a very different way. And can I make my image of God fit into the reality of my century? If I didn't, I don't see how I could be a Christian. But it's because I fight that battle daily. And
how do you speak of God?
Well, I try not to speak of God as a being. I think that's where we all get in trouble. I don't see God as an external being, supernatural in power, living somewhere above the sky and periodically invading the earth. What I think I can do, without being idolatrous, is to talk about not God, but my experience of God, then I'm talking about something that I can relate to. And I have to face the fact that my experience might be delusional. I've been in mental institutions, and I find a lot of delusional talk about God. Mm-hmm. Maybe mine is too, but I don't think so. I believe that I experience God as a source of life, and therefore I have to regard life as holy. And the more deeply and fully I live, the more I think I make God visible. Mm-hmm. I experience God as a source of love, and this is primarily the Jesus story. But if God's a source of love, the only way I can worship God is by loving. And the more deeply and fully I'm able to transcend my limits and love another person, then the more I think God becomes visible. Mm-hmm. And then I borrow a phrase from Paul Tillich, who was my shaping theologian. Tillich defined God not as a being, but the ground of being. Right. And that's a phrase people have a hard time translating. But if God is the ground of being, then the only way I worship God is to become all that I can be. And then to try to build a world where everybody can become all that they can be, because that's the way you reveal the presence of God. Well, that puts every prejudice to rout, it seems to mm-hmm. me. And it's so deeply biblical. When you go back and look at Paul, and when he wrote Galatians, he said, once you get inside the Christ experience, you discover there's no such thing as a Jew or a Gentile or a man or a woman, or bond or free. And I would add to that, gay or straight, Catholic or Protestant, Jew or Muslim, every category you want. There's just a common humanity. Now, how do we enhance that humanity in such a way as to become humane? I think humanism is a religious ideal. I remember being named the Humanist of the Year once in New York by an organization, and my critics wrote and said, well, now I've always believed you weren't a Christian. Now I know you're just a humanist. I think the opposite of being a humanist is to be inhumane. Mm-hmm. I think Christian humanism is a very real possibility. And the fact that at the center of the Christ story, there is the image of God taking on human form would indicate to me there must be something okay about being human. Mm-hmm. And if we can enhance the humanity of people, then I think we're able to transcend all the barriers.
Yeah. But Bishop Spong, what is it about sex in the church? I mean, I know that we pay too much attention to Augustine, who seemed as screwed up on it as anybody.
That might not be the right verb to use, but
well, that's true.
But he certainly did. Well, the church is a funny institution. It probably knows less about sex than it knows about anything. I mean, some of the stuff we've come out with is really absurd. So the church gives you a definition. It says that if you want to be holy, you're a celibate male. That's a strange definition. That violates everything we know about nature and creation. Mm-hmm. And also, it's pretty obvious that once you repress healthy sexuality, what you get is not no sexuality. You get distorted sexuality. Right. So the church has dealt with all sorts of distortions of its premise, including the child abuse thing, which is a clear systemic sickness. You know, we said about women, there's only one ideal woman, and she's a virgin mother. Well, it's really difficult to be a virgin mother, so presumably only one person can pull that off. That means that every other woman has to accept the fact that she's less than ideal. Mm-hmm. So we build guilt into the situation. Then we say to women, well, since you can't be ideal, then you take a charge. You either become a virgin and join the nunnery, you become a mother, and that means you can't use any artificial birth control because that would make sex evil. So the prohibition against birth control is in that. And so a homosexual person just doesn't fit into the category, and so we regard that as evil. Yeah. Well, that's just plain crazy. And one of the things that's happening in our world is that education is gotten down into the ranks. You know, in the Middle Ages, the only people educated were the priests. Mm-hmm. Now, universal education, and I think the more we educate people, and that's why the fundamentalists fight so hard to keep evolution out of the public schools, because there's great power in education when people understand what the issues are. And, you know, you don't want to be on the wrong side. I don't debate today with members of the Flat Earth Society. That issue's closed. You know, it's not one that anybody wants to debate. I don't debate about whether homosexuality is evil or good. It's morally neutral. Yeah. So is heterosexuality. Can you misuse it? Of course. Yeah. And I think part of what the Christian church has got to do is to help people accept what they are and then find a way to live it out with dignity and holiness and integrity. Yeah. Instead of saying, well, you can't be that because that's unacceptable to us.
I want to go back to the question of identity. Who is a Christian?
Well, basically, it would be a follower of Jesus. But let's understand that religion exercises great psychological force in human beings' lives. Every human being I know looks for some kind of security. And one of the places you look for it is in religion. And if religion is going to give you security, then it's got to be the correct religion. That's why the Pope has to be infallible. That's why the Bible has to be inerrant. That's why you have to say, my religion is the only true religion. My church is the only true church. I control the access to God. Nobody comes to the Father but by me. All of those are the arguments that come out of human insecurity. But see, I think the purpose of Christianity, and maybe of all religion, but I can't speak for that, the purpose of Christianity is not to give us security. It's to give us the courage to embrace the radical insecurity of life with integrity and to keep walking forward. And that's very different. I don't want the peace of God that passeth Equanil or Prozac. I want something that gives me the courage to live in a terribly insecure and frantic world and to live with integrity and to recognize that I can't always change it. And the idea that we can somehow change or manage our world with our religion becomes an idolatry. But I don't think that's what the Christian faith is all about. If you look at the Bible, the images of Christianity were never majority images. The idea that we're supposed to set the pattern and rule the world. The images are you're the salt in the soup. You give the soup its flavor. You're the leaven in the loaf. You give the loaf its capacity to rise. You're the light in the darkness. To watch the Roman Catholic Church and women go at it over health care is an interesting thing because it's good to be Roman Catholic. It's good to be women. You've got two good things colliding, but they're colliding because they've got a different understanding of what their responsibility is. I would never want a Roman Catholic to violate their conscience. I would also never want them to impose their understanding of reality on the body politic. That's what the separation of church and state is all about, and wars have been fought over those issues. And if you're going to be a part of this society, you have to live with some compromises. That's just the way life goes.
And isn't that a basic principle to be recognized by those who seem to want to use political power as a tool to leverage a kind of what they see as a Christian nation?
If you look at American history, what we have going on today in the Tea Party is not unlike the Know-Nothing Party that came about in the middle of the 19th century, mm-hmm. and always comes out in great periods of stress and transition. Now, the fact is that in this country, power is being taken away from the white male establishment, and that's been going on for a long time. Mm-hmm. When this country was formed, only white males who owned land could vote. And I say only white males because they were the only people that owned land. Women couldn't own property in many states of the United States. And so what's happened to this country is that the power of white males to run the country and the economy has been broadened to the place they can't quite control it anymore. And the last election was devastating to that group of people because Mitt Romney won the majority of the white male votes, but he lost big among women, he lost big among blacks, he lost big among Latinos, and lost big among people under 40. You know, only white males over 40. And that's not enough. And if we look at the demographics of this country, that vote is that's going to keep going in that direction. You know, the great fear of the right wing today is not only that they've got an African-American in the White House, but they've got a woman standing in the wings ready to be eight more years. That's devastating for them. Yeah. And so, you know, that's why you get gridlock in this country, and that's why you get terrible political confrontation that never lasts, never gets anything accomplished. But anyway, I see this as the birth pangs of a new consciousness. I'm not worried about it. You can't buck consciousness. And what I think people need to recognize is that in every election, every 4 years when we elect a president, 8 years has gone by in terms of our voting blocks. Because every 4 years, 4 years of people have died, and 4 years of people have come of age. So in Obama's 8 years in the White House, you're going to have 16 years of a change in the voting body politic. And if Hillary is the president for the next 8 years, and that's highly speculative, she You know, she could be deceased by the time, you know. That's not good to speculate more than about a week in advance in politics. But that would mean 16 more years. That'd be 32 years. That means it's never going to be the same.
Yeah.
And when people see power slipping away, they're frantic. And part of the problem is that Christianity, as an organized religion, is in a fast free fall. The biggest movement in the church today is not the rise of fundamentalism. It's the rise of the secular society, the what I call the Church Alumni Association. They've gone out. And part of the problem for that is the church has not kept up with the times and has not engaged the issues that people are dealing with, so that when they come to church, they almost got to put their brains into a first century pretzel in order to understand worship, and they don't want to do that. So it's increasingly unpopular. When people like me and many others try to bring Christianity into the 21st century, the primary enemies we have are not the secular society. It's the right-wing religious who think we're violating everything about our religious background. I think that if you don't churn in that religious atmosphere and open up new possibilities, that there's no future in the Christian faith. I just don't believe that the idea that you're born in sin and that you're infected with original sin and that God has to rescue you, and the way God rescues you is to kill his son on the cross so that he can pay, presumably God, for your evil, makes any sense to anybody. And yet we've been saying Jesus died for my sins for so many years that people think that that must be the heart of the Christian faith. That's the atonement theology, and it's basically a gift of the fourth century. It's a gift of St. Augustine's, among other people. That's been a stream, but I think we're in a period where it's got to change. And we've gone through that before. Yeah. Now, Christianity was born in a Jewish world. All of our symbols were Jewish, and we had to translate them into a Gentile world. And Augustine is the guy that turned Christianity into being something that was in dialogue with Plato. And then Plato ran out, and Aquinas came along in the 13th century, and he turned Christianity to be in dialogue with Aristotelian thought. Then the Reformation came along, and the world was beginning to get all sorts of new ideas coming in from the East, and humanism was rising. And the Reformation was an attempt to turn Christianity to deal with this new reality. And that was the first time when we couldn't keep the whole body together. So we broke into a Protestant and a Catholic thing, which has never been healed. And what I think we're doing today is that the worldview of the 21st century is so far removed from the worldview of religion that they're thought to be mutually exclusive. If you can separate the Christ experience from the explanation of the Christ experience, then you have a chance to talk about that experience in a different language. But if you can't separate them, if you've decided that the Bible, which is a first century explanation of the Christ experience, or the creeds, which are a fourth century explanation of the Christ experience, or the most of the liturgies of the churches, which come out of the 13th century, if those things are essential to the experience, then there's no way you're going to keep the experience alive.
That's the late Bishop John Shelby Spong in a 2013 appearance on this program. More memorable excerpts are on the way. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. The first time he appeared on State of Belief in 2009, Bishop Spong had just published Jesus for the Non-Religious. For countless people hungry for a way to re-engage with faith in spite of alienation from religion. Anything in particular prompt this particular book?
Well, as I said in the preface, that it's been a lifetime work. The church's basic Christian myth says that we were created in God's image, perfect, and then we disobeyed God, whether that's metaphorical or historical.
We called it original sin. We were expelled from the Garden of Eden. Someone said the Garden of Eden became the first gated community where you couldn't get in. And we were told that we could do nothing to save ourselves except wait on God to deliver us. And the Jesus story was told in terms of that image. Well, if you live on the other side of Charles Darwin, we know that there was no such thing as a perfect creation. So we can't possibly fall from something we never possessed, and we can never be restored to something we've never had. Life has been emerging for 4 to 5 billion years. And the problem with human life is not that we are fallen sinners, like the church has proclaimed for centuries. The problem is we haven't yet become human. And so we got to recast the Jesus story, not as the rescuer of the fallen, which makes little sense to people today, but as the empowerment of God to enable us to become fully human. And I think it turns the whole direction of Christianity around, and I think it's the way Christianity will have to go in the future. And I'm excited about that possibility.
I think you and I both know some are going kicking and screaming all the way.
Well, that's true. But Weldon, I grew up in the South, and I lived through the race battles and the civil rights movement and the desegregation. There are some people that are never going to adjust to reality, and there'll always be pockets of negativity. The fact is that time moves on. Like that old hymn says, time bears all its sons away. And if you can't adjust, your children adjust to the new reality. And if they can't adjust, your grandchildren adjust. And we have the same thing today. We've got some people that are so deeply homophobic that they would die before they see homosexual people fully welcomed into the life of the church. And the fact is they will die. And homosexuality will be looked upon in another 25 or 30 years, sort of like the way we looked on the sin of witchcraft or racism or the way we treated women or the way we were prejudiced against left-handed people. The world is going to move on, and we've got to be courageous. And if you're in touch with truth, you don't compromise in order to make people happy. Racism, sexism, homophobia, all of those things diminish the life of great numbers of human beings and cannot possibly be part of the Christian faith.
John, I'm wondering, even if there was not a direct cause and effect, as you were writing this book, did you think at all about the writings of Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins against religion?
Yeah, very much. I know Richard Dawkins. I've never met Sam Harris. And I like both of those books. Because the God they don't believe in and the God they're calling a delusion is, I think, exactly that. What I don't think they understand is that that's not the only way we can describe or describe our God experience. If the only God that people know is the manipulative supernatural power who is constantly doing miracles and constantly enhancing guilt, then I think a reformation against that God would be quite in order. And Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris may be in the vanguard of that reformation without knowing it. I really think that they call the church to face the fact that the way we've thought about God in the past is simply inadequate for today. And if you don't have another way to talk about God, then you've got to face the fact that, as they are proclaiming, that God is a delusion. I don't believe God is a delusion, and I think we can talk about our God experience in a far more profound way than that. And I find people hungry for that kind of message all over this world, even in the Deep South, even in the Bible Belt, where I journey right frequently, and have massive numbers of people come out who are concerned to hear something different.
If you use the classic literal definition of the word atheist as one who rejects theism, do you consider yourself an atheist?
Well, that's a loaded question, because that makes good headlines. The atheist bishop, I was called that in England one time, a religion reporter who didn't understand much about those dynamics. Theism is a human definition of God. I think a very inadequate human definition of God. And atheism literally means not to be a theist. Now, as long as people think that theism is the only way you can talk about God, an atheist is one who doesn't believe in any God. That would not be an accurate description. I consider myself a God-intoxicated human being. I'm almost a mystic in my experience of the reality of the holy, but without an adequate vocabulary to talk about it. So that I think that's a difficult question to answer until you define those terms. I am not a theist, but I believe profoundly and deeply in the reality of of a power beyond human power that is the source of life, the source of love, the ground of being, and I call that power God, and that's the power I believe that I discern present in the life of Jesus of Nazareth, and indeed in my own life.
John, I know you've been asked this question before because some people think around these very particular issues. People get confused about you saying that you believe in the resurrection of Jesus, though you dispute the story of the physical resurrection and ascension. Talk about how you answer that question, because it gives us insight into how you deal with a lot of other questions.
Well, I'd be glad to. I've written a 350-page book entitled Resurrection Myth or Reality, and I think it's both. I think there is a reality that I can't quite describe, and there is the mythical language that the church has used to describe it. Christianity was born in some burst of enormous energy sometime after the death of Jesus of Nazareth. Paul is the first person to write about that, and he writes 20 to 34 years after whatever that experience was. And Paul does not have any concept of resurrection being the resuscitation of a deceased body that walks out of a grave. He has the sense that resurrection and ascension are the same thing, that God has raised Jesus into the very life of God, where he participates in God's life and is therefore eternally alive and eternally available to us. But how do you describe that with human vocabulary? You're talking about a God experience, and you're trying to make sense out of it with human language. A horse can't tell you what it means to be human. A human being can't tell you what it means to be God. So we're lost in a difficulty with that. I find it fascinating that the first gospel, Mark, was written about 70, has no story of the risen Jesus appearing to anybody. Mark just confronts the women with an empty tomb and with a message that he has transcended the boundaries of death. You get the first hint of a physical resuscitation being the definition of that experience in Matthew, and it's only a hint because Matthew has the women who go to the tomb actually see Jesus and grab his feet. But Mark says the women did not see Jesus, and Luke says the women did not see Jesus, so that looks like a heightening by Matthew. And if you take that one out, the resurrection doesn't become a physical resuscitation until you get to Luke, and that would be the late 9th or maybe even the early 10th decade, and John, which would be the late 10th decade. All I'm trying to get people to say, to see, is that there is a profound difference between the experience of Jesus as breaking the boundaries of death and the way that got explained.
I have a hunch that the reason you are read so intently and so widely is that when you write for non-religious people, people who have been very religious but afraid to be honest, find in your books the answers to questions, or at least responses to questions, that they've always wanted to ask but never in public. What is your hope regarding the response to this vision of Jesus from believers?
I think you have pegged it exactly right. I get letters time after time that says, you are writing the things that I've always believed, but I never felt that it was okay to believe that. You've given me permission to articulate my faith in a new direction. I think God is real. I think Jesus makes God visible in some human form. And I think the call of the Christian faith is to make us more deeply and fully human. And if we don't become more deeply and fully human, religion will be the thing that causes human beings to commit genocide, I think, against each other, because that's the way we're going. That's hardly a way you can refer to the God of life and love and being, as that you kill each other in the name of God. That's where we've gotten to in organized religion.
That's Bishop John Shelby Spong on State of Belief Radio from 2009. Now to the final interview we were able to record in March of 2018, just weeks before the bishop retired from public life. At what point in your life did you realize that changes had to be made, that the Christianity you had been taught was not the Christianity you believed and wanted to know more about? When did that happen?
It came in waves, actually. The first wave was that I grew up in the South in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I heard all sorts of justifications of segregation, and it didn't make a lot of sense to me. And that challenged me to begin to look at the symbols of the Christian faith in a brand new way. It developed later when my daughters began to be teenagers, and I suddenly looked at the way the church had treated women, and it didn't sound right to me. And so it drove me back to the scriptures and back to the faith in a brand new way. And finally, there was a time in my early Episcopal career when I took notice of the fact that the church treated homosexuals with terrible impunity, and that didn't sound right to me. It didn't feel right. It didn't jive with what I knew about homosexual people. And so into a study I went and came out a couple of years later with a brand new theology of inclusivity that included gay and lesbian, transgender people. Mm-hmm. And so I realized that no matter what stand I wanted to take, I had to fight the Bible as presently understood, and I had to fight the church as it articulated its faith. And those things just required me to think. Now, one thing you can do is to give up the Bible and the church at that point when they show that they so little understand. And the other thing you can do is you can go more deeply into them than you ever have before. Mm. And for reasons I don't fully understand, I decided to go into them deeply. And what I've come out with is a Christian faith that is wide and broad and deep and beyond all of the categories of church talk and Christian traditionalism.
Yeah.
And it's been a wonderful ride. I'm 86, and that's the last book I'm going to write, and it's a good one to finish my work with.
You write that neither ancient creeds nor the Reformation can produce a living faith today. So what can?
Well, I think it's a deep inquiry. It's certainly not the traditional creed. That's a 4th century product. And the way we thought in the 4th century has been just totally abandoned. We used to talk about the God above the sky. That God makes no sense to us today. We know that above the sky is our galaxy. And that's a very big galaxy, bigger than many people thought when the creed was built. The galaxy we live in, it takes light 100,000 years to go from one end of our galaxy to the other, traveling at 186,000 miles per second. And that's just one of billions and billions of galaxies. Above us is galaxies, suns, stars, black holes, dark matter, but there's no God there. So the projection is that if you can't locate God somewhere, God's difficult to locate anywhere, and that's where we are today. It's difficult to think about God today because all of the ways we've talked about God in the past have simply vanished. And they vanished because we got higher knowledge about how this world operates and what constitutes this world, and you can't correlate that with Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
We used to say things like, man is created in the image of God, and we usually said man, too. Human life is created in the image of God, and that was a sacred symbol. But we know now that human life has evolved over millions of years of evolutionary history. Human life is somewhere between 6 billion years old and 250,000 years old, depending on how you define human life. And none of that can be translated into the categories of the Bible. The first book of the Bible wasn't written until 1000 B.C. It's a very late book in human history. Of course, we didn't write for most of those years. We've only been able to write since about 12,000, 15,000 years ago. And so everything we know about the Bible is limited in time and space, and we cannot escape that.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to begin to think in a vastly different way. When I was in seminary, I read a book, I've forgotten the author's name, but it was entitled Your God is Too Small. It was J.B. Phillips. We thought that was a great book, and it was a terrible book. But it had a great title, and that's what we need to be aware of today. The God of human beings, the God of men and women, is today too small to be God of this universe. And if we can't find a way to let God grow into the fullness of what God is, then there's going to be nobody that will pay attention to this God.
So what will it take for people satisfied with traditional orthodoxy to realize the need for changes and the spiritual courage to explore changes?
Well, if they really are convinced of that, they won't do it. I think what we've got going on is that most people are not convinced of that, mm-hmm. and they have to find something. But that's when I say most people don't want to discuss this because they're sure that if they discuss it, what they believe will disappear. And so they sort of blankly say the creeds every Sunday mm-hmm. and don't ever raise questions about it. If you get a church where the minister wants to raise questions, he's not likely to make it. As he would undercut the security system of those people. We live in a world where it's going to take ministers of brave courage to chart out into the distant, mm-hmm. into the unknown future. But that's what our faith is about. Abraham left Ur of the Chaldees to start a new faith out in the wilderness that never was known before. We always are leaving the known for the unknown. What faith really means biblically is the ability to leave what you know for what you do not know and the confidence that you're going to find God in some form when you get there.
If someone was doing a testimonial, how would you want them to speak of you in a manner that would convey the changes in belief that have occurred in your life?
Well, I'm going next week down to Richmond to speak in the Lenten service. And they knew me as a priest during the 60s and 70s, but it's a very different church today. And we talk about those days and the conflicts we had, and there's a lot of laughter and jokes that go on about it. The seminary I went to had as its motto, teach the truth of God, come whence it may, cost what it will. And that's guided me for a long time. And the truth of God, it cannot be encapsulated. It cannot be articulated in words. It's bigger than words. My words always limit the truth of God. Mm-hmm. And so you live in a world where you've got to go beyond every symbol, every statement of the past, into a mystery. You don't know what's out there, but you know that God must be out there. Whatever God is, however God is defined, I don't know what to do with that, but to be faithful. And the church I go to satisfies me about 25% of the time. I've got a wonderful rector. She's absolutely fantastic. And I suspect that if she satisfied me 50% of the time, she wouldn't satisfy her congregation. And I try to accept that as that's the best of all possible worlds. That's the best I can deal with. But I think it must be members of the church that want more. I find it all the time. We set up a lectureship in our church called the Spong Lectureship, and it's dedicated to bringing to this church people who are walking the edges so that every year they bring someone in who's walking the edges of the Christian faith to challenge their thinking. And they do that wonderfully. They look forward to that, mm-hmm. but they're not where those people are. But they are glad to know that there's a land out there where some people are wandering around that don't fit in conveniently with the church as it presently exists.
Bishop Spong, it's always an honor to spend time with you and to hear your words. I thank you so much for doing this again. You are a great hero and a great model for whom we are eternally grateful.
I thank you so much for your love and support, and I'm glad to be on your program.
From 2018, that's Bishop John Shelby Spong on State of Belief. We're remembering the life and legacy of the bishop who passed away September 12, 2021. When I first discovered the writing of Bishop John Shelby Spong, I felt like I had discovered a whole new introduction to religion generally and Christianity in particular. Bishop Spong challenged me, ushered me into thoughts that no one else has ever inspired in me, and without fear, dodged no topic that needed to be addressed related to justice, human rights, religious freedom, and spirituality. The bishop once described his life as a journey from the literalism and conservative theology of his childhood to an expansive view of Christianity. I was on that journey myself, and here was help from someone who knew how to travel it. After the excitement of reading one or two of his books, I could hardly wait to read his next publication. While I devoured Spong's books with great gratitude, as did thousands of other readers, I could not understand why so many people criticized him, called him a heretic, and seemed to be afraid of him. I was stunned by critics who said the bishop did not like the Bible. My perspective was that Spong liked the Bible so much that he wanted to study it vigorously and teach it carefully to help people better understand the scriptures and know how to use them with passion and compassion in their lives. Bishop Spong helped me see that the Bible is not just a book on which to meditate. It is a book that inspires actions of change that contribute to a better world. Several years later, I had the chance to meet Bishop Spong and getting to know him more personally. What a privilege. Interacting with Spong during meetings we both attended, listening to his reasoning, watching his passionate devotion to working for a better world, I came to respect this man as well as to learn from his writing. He appreciated tradition, but he also sought contemporary understandings of the universe. I began to think that his critics were simply scared of him, fearful that he might change their minds and force them to deal with new questions and perhaps new perspectives. When Bishop Spong became one of our cherished guests on State of Belief, the producer of the show, Ray Kirstein, and I looked forward to every conversation with this insightful and fresh-thinking man. Bishop Spong is the only guest who has ever invited us into his home for a sit-down conversation. It happened in 2013, and he and his wife could not have been nicer. Christine served us tea as we waited for the bishop, then 82, to finish a treadmill workout in his basement gym. Then we spent an unforgettable hour delving deeply into his latest book as well as his lifetime of faithful exploration and liberating leadership. A prominent theme in Spong's writing was that the popular, permanent, and literal interpretations of Christian scripture are not sustainable and do not speak honestly to the situation of modern Christian communities. He believed in a more nuanced approach to scripture informed by scholarship and compassion, which can be consistent with both Christian tradition and contemporary understandings of Christianity and the universe. After all, he authored the groundbreaking book Rescuing the Bible from Fundamentalism all the way back to 1991. Over these past few days since Spong's death, numerous people have made me sick at my stomach with their harsh condemnations of his ministry and writings and caused me to wonder what kind of God they believe in and how they have so misunderstood the teachings and life of Jesus. I've heard Bishop Spong say that he is a Christian because he believes Jesus Christ fully expressed the presence of a compassionate and selfless loving God. After conversations about God with the bishop, I was always filled with mystery, holiness, and love. Just yesterday, I read a Southern Baptist leader's condemnation of Spong, claiming that he denied virtually every major Christian doctrine. The charge brought to my mind what Bishop Spong called the sin of certainty, people claiming that they somehow have captured eternal truth in the specific form they themselves have created. I know the critic. He was claiming his own theology as Christian doctrine. In truth, the demand that all believers unthinkingly hew a dogmatic line is what led to the Crusades, the Inquisition, and more recently support for slavery and the Holocaust on the part of many quote-unquote good Christians. The most rigid followers of non-Christian faiths have been just as vulnerable to profound evils in the name of doctrine. John Shelby Spong called that out unflinchingly, and so it's no surprise he had many haters, including powerful faith leaders. But the bishop also came to see both the divine in all faith traditions, unforgettably writing, God is not a Christian. God is not a Jew, or a Muslim, or a Hindu, or a Buddhist. All of those human systems which human beings have created to try to help us walk into the mystery of God. I honor my tradition, he said. I walk through my tradition, but I don't think my tradition defines God. I think it only points me to God. In his book, A New Christianity for a New World, he shares the following, I'm quoting, "I have deliberately sought to walk beyond the traditional boundaries of the Christianity in which I was raised and to develop a new vocabulary in order to open new avenues into the holy. For years, I had looked for such a book and the person who wrote it. I found that person. Bishop Spong helped me step after step on a search not for a new Christianity, but for a real, not cultural, but real, authentic Christianity that changes hearts and minds, politics, economics, and values, fights for human rights, and elevates love to the pinnacle of life." I already miss him, but when I miss him, I give thanks for him. He deserves rest, but not even death will silence his unforgettable truths. Truths that, if put in action, will make us better people. Blessings on you, Bishop Spong. Rest in peace. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. Go there. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week, one person for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics, including part two of my extended interview with dissenting Catholic theologian Father Charles Curran. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.